Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 510 for comics originally released on May 17th, 2017. Now, starting us off in DC is Flash number 22. This is part 4 and the final part of The Button storyline. And while The Button may not sound that exciting, for those of you who are lost in time and not here in the moment, this is the first major story arc kind of spilling out of the events of the DC Universe Rebirth number 1 that came out about a year ago that really altered the DC Universe significantly. That's when they brought back the Wally West Flash, and Batman and Flash realized somebody's been monkeying with time in the DC Universe. And this is when they were investigating the button that embedded itself in the wall of the Batcave. And it crossed over between issues of Batman and the Flash, both 21 and 22 of this volume. And I was, you know, when I put these episodes together, you know, we pick stuff a week or two out, about 2 weeks out usually, and then I'll, in the intervening time, grab the covers, get the episode image ready and stuff like that. And when I did this for this one, I was a little miffed because the cover in my mind is a bit of a spoiler. I've got the cover here that has Jay Garrick very clearly front and center on the cover, in something evocative of one of his Flash comics issues or whatnot. So that told me going in, oh, we may see Jay Garrick. Did that bother you at all in terms of spoiler?
You warned me ahead of time, so I read the other three first. And then just grabbed it and said that there might have been a spoiler on there. And then didn't even really glance at the cover. Just kind of dove right into the story.
Smart. When I dove into the story myself, we get to that first page and we've got this caption, yellow text on a blue background. But it has a Flash logo on it. And I'm like, well, this must be the Flash who's giving us this caption, this narration or whatever. Till I get a few captions in and I realize he's referring to Barry Allen in like the third person. This isn't Barry. Based on the contents and the cover, it was pretty clear it was Jay Garrick. But since we don't see Jay for a little bit, honestly, I was a little annoyed by that. I thought if they simply had not put the Flash logo, the Barry Allen Flash logo there, that might have worked better for me.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. When I was reading it, it just was a narration bubble that just was branded with the comic that it was in, but I didn't put that together that, oh, obviously this is a Flash narration. Yeah, I didn't do that.
I mean, what was interesting was I think near the end when it switches from Jay's narration to Barry's narration.
Yeah, they're in red with also a Flash lightning bolt.
And a red circle around the white.
Yes, yeah.
Versus the yellow against the white, which is funny because Barry's logo is the yellow with the white, not the red sort of a thing. I mean, it's a minor thing, and I know it may be a nitpick, but in comics, you don't have, oh, I recognize that voice by sound. So they do things like this with the captions to work around that.
Yeah.
And they were cheating. So that kind of annoyed me. I liked how Reverse Flash had some callbacks to the various ways he's died over the years. How long have you been reading The Flash? Or do you read it regularly?
No, I'm sporadic.
Okay, that's fair enough. They mentioned when Barry had broken the neck of the Reverse Flash. That's going all the way back to Flash 324, where Barry accidentally breaks the Reverse Flash's neck after he's threatened to kill Barry's then new fiance, because he had already years prior killed Iris. So he was like, don't do this again kind of a thing. And then accidentally, and it was an accident, it was just, yeah, whatever. It actually motivated the Trial of the Flash, which ran for another, over the course of two years in that title, up until it ended in around issue 350. I think it was actually 350, around the time of Crisis on Infinite Earths. Some of the stuff they did here when Eobard, you know, arrives there and then, oh, show yourself. And then we kind of get, okay, he's toasted. It's like, dude, we knew he was going to get toasted. I was hoping to see a little bit more. And then we get to what was supposed to be this big reveal of you know, who is this person who's been talking to Barry? It's like, well, of course it's Jay. You had him on the cover. You know, this moment didn't work for me because of how they marketed the book. And that kind of annoyed me. And there was an aspect of the way Jay was drawn, particularly when he's giving his name and saying, hey, I'm a friend of yours, that looked a lot like John Wesley Shipp, or at least a lot more than he used to look like.
Oh, yeah. It was, especially that first close-up of his face, and it was almost photo-referenced, I thought, at that in that panel. And just really right out of the last episode that he was in.
You know, and then, I mean, and I get why they do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But when Barry's like, you know, Jay's doing the same thing Wally did in the DC Universe Rebirth. Of, oh, just say my name, remember me, and I'll be saved. And Barry is reaching out, what's your name, you know, as he touches him, and then kind of a kapow, it doesn't work. And what bothered me with that is just a moment ago, Jay told him his name. It's like, dude, do you not pay attention? Of course, if this were the TV Flash, he'd run back in time a few minutes to go listen again and then come back. But it's, I was disappointed this didn't bring Jay back into the DC Universe proper, but they kind of, I get why they, well, I don't get why they didn't, but they were leading up to, oh, it's the same moment again, but for a different Flash. It would have been a little, cliche is not the right word, but redundant. I left this issue in this storyline because, I mean, they go for another page, a couple of pages here, but then it kind of is basically teasing the Doomsday Clock storyline that starts in November is the next major chapter in the Rebirth meta arc. And I had really mixed feelings about the Button storyline. There were aspects of it that I really loved, really enjoyed, but ultimately things aren't that much different than they were before, if at all. And it's funny because I think there's a retcon in the storyline that nobody probably fully realizes. And the stuff here at the end, of the bat signal goes up and Bruce is debating if he's going to answer it because of the stuff his father said of, hey, don't be Batman. Go have a happy life. I'm sorry. Bruce Wayne is been going down this path of being Batman since he was a kid. And it has redefined who he is and who he will always be. So while that discussion with his father in the previous issue over in Batman may fundamentally change how Bruce moves forward as Batman, it will not, in my mind, influence if he moves forward as Batman. He doesn't know how not to be, at least in my mind. So I think there's a little bit of, we were supposed to think that Bruce's world has fundamentally changed. I think it's a bit of a turning point. It may lighten him up, but it doesn't prevent him from being Batman. For the Flash, his world hasn't changed really at all. You could argue that it's an awareness of the Jay Garrick Flash, although given he couldn't remember the name for more than 30 seconds or 20 seconds or whatever. I'm going to challenge that. I'm actually going to suggest that the change to the Flash that is revealed here with Barry Allen isn't an awareness of Jay Garrick, but the reveal that he had no awareness of Jay Garrick. And people are going to say, well, how could he? Whatever. One of the things that people may have forgotten about, and it's easy to forget because most of us haven't read the original showcase that had the Flash, Barry Allen was a comic book fan who read the Jay Garrick Flash comics. He should have recognized Jay on those grounds alone. And for him not to, it, again, in my mind, changes very subtly and almost subversively a key aspect of Flash's backstory. And one could argue that it always happened as maybe part of Flashpoint, and we just didn't know any better until now. But, you know, on the one hand, I really enjoyed the storyline. On the other hand, it really didn't do anything.
Yeah, I'm kind of on that same wavelength. I had built this up, anticipated this, which is part my fault, but also part DC's, because since the standalone DC Rebirth issue, they really haven't done much to follow up with that momentum that they had. And so once this was announced, I was excited they're going to get back into this mystery that we were promised many, many months ago and dig into it whole cloth. And it was good. I enjoyed it. And there's it was fun. There was a lot of fun stuff in here. But yeah, it didn't quite move the needle as far as I had hoped, and I feel a little empty waiting for the next go round, and not really knowing how long that's going to be,
if it'll do anything,
and if it'll advance the ball any for me. But yeah, I think what was here was fun. It would be cool if there was a standalone title that was following Rebirth through, even if it was once a month, and, you know, a little slower paced. That would be okay, just as long as it kind of kept at it, and maybe it was a nice little team-up book between Flash and Batman, and just continued to chip away and crossed over with whoever it needed to cross over with. I like this, but I just don't know why they saved it so long, and I don't know why it has to go away so quickly.
I think if we had gotten this, say, 6 months ago, around the end of the year, and it's like, okay, they've done these little teasers here and there, and now, you know, as the holidays come around, we get this great four-part, you know, story.
Oh, it would have been great, yeah.
I would have been much happier with it. And it's not that it's a bad story. It's got some very interesting little tidbits. The whole being able for Bruce and his father to talk to each other through that little pocket of time of a Flashpoint that somehow survived for a little bit. I mean, in my mind, the time stream is going forward, but for the duration of a Flashpoint, it's literally like doing a little whirlpool kind of eddy sort of a thing, spinning out when Flash, you know, saves his mother, doing all the events of Flashpoint, and then circling back to intersect back into the regular timeline as Flash unsaves his mother. And it's fun, it's cool, it's interesting. For them to have done that, to have tossed in a bunch of Easter eggs here and there, but ultimately it amounts to nothing. And even the cool Easter eggs in that JLA trophy room or whatever they were calling it, we're never going to really see any of those again, probably. I'd be surprised if many get acknowledged by other writers or even if other writers know what some of them are. As much as I want to say this was a great step forward for the Rebirth storyline, it was great that they made an attempt at stepping forward. It's great that they spent four issues playing in this space. Again, I enjoyed the storyline as I was in it, but it's a roller coaster ride. The minute you get off, you realize there's really not much to take with you. And maybe I'm just being harsh on this because it's been a full year since they set things in motion, and we're really, again, no further off. It's not like they've got new leads to go chase down or anything moving forward. So there's a huge level of frustration I have here.
Yeah, I mean, the buttons, you know, crackled and sparked and kind of set some things in motion that we thought would lead to something. And we got some interesting interactions with characters, and I really enjoyed those. But I don't know anything more about the button than I knew before I started reading
it. You know, if they had changed this issue a bit, I'm not going to say a little bit, because what I'm going to suggest is significant. If instead of it being Jay that was kind of, hey, you know, save me, or whatever, they were hearing something, but they couldn't quite make it out, and it almost sounds like a hissing noise or whatever. And then when they get to the point where they reveal Jay or whatever, have it be this huge crack of lightning that lands them back at the Batcave. And they look around, wondering, what was that? But as that's happening, they hear the full sound that they weren't, and they realize what that was Shazam. And this could have been where they introduced those various Shazam characters that were in the two-page splash at the end of Rebirth that we've never seen.
And that would have at least been a new path that they were going down instead of, you know, it's so reminiscent of what Wally was going through in the DC Rebirth issue. You know, there's some of those same beats happening that you're thinking, what? Why are they kind of treading this ground that they just tread? And so it feels like there's either a greater purpose for it beyond what has been revealed, or this was the best they could come up with.
Well, to me, they're still teasing the JSA, you know, versus if they had some of these Shazam family characters, new Shazam family characters that we've never seen before, come in with a, oh, you remember us. And as a reader, I'd be like, no, I've never seen you before. They could have then dispersed out into a couple of different titles to reconnect with their friends and whatnot that still don't remember them. But it also would have been a, you know, kind of catch the lightning kind of a thing as it goes through the DC universe and revitalizes it or something. There were ways they could have gone that could have been less a repetition from what they had done a year ago, moved the thing forward, and really, I think, gotten some people excited, whether they were necessarily Shazam family fans or not. As it was, they stole their own thunder with the covers. They failed to deliver, and it just really kind of reinforced the longing I have for some of these characters that they just haven't brought back on stage. So I was
now did the Dr. Manhattan tease of a panel, maybe Dr. Manhattan tease.
Oh, it's definitely Dr. Manhattan.
And then the transition of the drop of blood into the Superman logo, did that do anything for you? Did that get you excited about anything there?
It made me think that the drop of blood transition into the Superman logo was incredibly forced. It's almost like they were trying to zoom in there and zoom out elsewhere, but it didn't quite work for me. We've already gotten it abundantly clear that Dr. Manhattan is one of the people behind this. It does make me think that at some point I need to reread Watchmen. But
we have a grand total of maybe 3 panels of blue skin so far in a year, correct? But I didn't miss anything, did I? Did I miss something and something else?
No, but I think even here, didn't we get more than a few panels? Well, I guess more of it's by... We got the one panel with the... Well, 2 if you count the... No, it's still the same panel, even if you count the reflection. How about the other one when Eobard was getting toasted? No, we don't really see anything there. It's clear by implication who they're going after or who's the threat and stuff, but... To me, what got me curious about Watchmen was the dialogue there at the end.
Yeah.
Just to place it in the timeline of Watchmen.
But this slow trickle, I mean, is there going to be a payoff or is there going to be a deflation when we finally get around to addressing it?
I think it comes down to how good it is.
Yeah.
If this had had payoff where, wow, this fundamentally changed the DC universe in some way we hadn't anticipated, you know, bringing back the Shazam family or going in some direction.
Yeah.
That would have been really cool. But it didn't do that. If anything, it's almost trying to negate Batman.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, dude. You're not fooling anyone. They're not getting rid of Batman. They're not retiring Batman. Bruce will be Batman because he is the best-selling character they've got, and he's just the coolest character. So they overplayed and underplayed their hand simultaneously, which is a pretty neat trick.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know what? These... I guess expectations aside, I still thought it was a solid comic in it, and it was a nice 4-issue, high intensity, a lot of stuff going on in those 4 issues, and it really propelled from one to the next. Of course, I read them that way on purpose, so I don't know what they would have been like reading them from week to week. But
did you think it was even between the 4 installments?
No. I preferred the Batman issues.
I would agree with that, and I would say that the second Batman issue had the best character stuff. The first Batman one probably had some of the best art, and yeah, certainly some of the best action.
Yeah. I mean, I think I like the button as a whole better than I like this specific issue, but I still thought this was good, and enjoyed it, gave it a B, and I would recommend other comic fans read it.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I'm at. I would say the button overall is certainly worth reading. As much as I would like to give this a higher rating and stuff, it's good. I was frustrated by it, but not because it was in any way bad other than a little lackluster of an ending. This was not the high point of the 4-issue arc. I would really, for me, it's a toss-up between the 2 issues of Batman. That first one with Fabok art and just the way they launched the story, and it takes place in literally like a 2-minute time frame. It was really well done.
Yeah.
And then seeing Bruce and Thomas together in that third part, really fun. Again, some of what they've done with the Flash and all that stuff on that side of it was good too. I didn't think the art was as good as the Batman parts. But for me, this is getting that B rating because while I really enjoyed the storyline, and it was, I think, head and shoulders a bit above kind of just, I don't say the pedestrian stuff, but some of the other stuff we're getting elsewhere or whatnot. This should have been, I should have been raving about this, saying, wow, this was brilliant. You have to read it. If you read no other comics from DC this month, these are it. And I can't say that.
Yeah.
It's up there. I think if you're into the meta arc, you've definitely got to read this. But I was prepared for my socks to be blown off, and they were not.
And there's definitely a difference to Tom King's Batman than Scott Snyder's, and even some of the creators before. I mean, I've also there's an issue with the in 23 with him and Swamp Thing. And he's different there as well, and there's just a little difference in what kind of I expect from Batman and Bruce Wayne and how they should act, and kind of Tom King's interpretation. So there's nothing wrong with it, but I do feel like he is making it his own, and maybe going a little making some different choices than what you would expect based on having read Batman for a long, long time.
I will say the issue of Batman that came out this week, the 23rd, issue 23, with Swamp Thing, I thought was just so-so. I thought Batman was a little out of character, particularly there at the end. But I think that they don't have
out a of character for maybe your understanding of him, but pretty much on point for how Tom King has been writing him.
I think Batman is a bit more of a cool customer than he was there.
Yeah, I'll agree.
And I think Swamp Thing was out of character, too.
Yeah. But I will give Tom King a little creative license to make him his own.
That's fair, but I think DC needs to really solidify on who Batman is, because there was a scene in part 2 in Flash 21, and it was a fun scene. Bruce is in bed, you know, healing from the, you know, previous issue, and they're talking, he and Flash are kind of comparing notes on the investigation. And, you know, Flash is like, oh, I scanned this with this. And Bruce is like, well, yours or mine? Flash is like, mine. And Bruce is like, did you run multiple tests to compare the results? And Flash is like, Bruce, come on. You know, the next word was from Bruce. Sorry. Well, first off, Batman doing the back and forth, hey, did you double check your work or whatever? Definitely going to happen. Flash being, come on, dude, I'm a professional too. Going to happen. Yeah. Batman apologizing to somebody? Kind of surprising. I think it makes sense in this context. But it's one of those things that there were aspects of this exchange that felt like this was a guy who would dress up as a bat. This was not Batman.
Yeah, and this is not the guy that is being referred to in other DC books either. I mean, the way that Batman is talked about and acts in, you know, the Superman books or Super Sons, or, you know, he's a different guy than this Batman.
Well, there's a bit here where he's hesitant to reveal something to Flash. He's a little embarrassed by it or whatever. I cannot imagine Damian Wayne being told about this encounter and believing it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, of course, some of that's just on Damian. He's a little full of himself. But they're doing some fun stuff here, but there's also some things that you can really kind of challenge and question.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, not in a bad way, but it's not one of those things where I've read some comics where it's like, man, they know these characters. This felt right. They were close. They were really close. But this is something that I wish they had landed the ending better than they did, because ultimately I came out disappointed.
And now we wait till November to pick up this storyline again. Does that sound right?
Sounds right. That's when the Doomsday Clock starts up. It's going to be somewhere between, what did they say, a 7 and 12 issue or 13, you know, whatever. It goes for how long it goes. If it's another short arc, we'll do what we did here, review the last issue. If it's a longer one, we may do first and last, don't know. Or we may be over the whole meta arc by then. I doubt it. I'm a hardcore DC fan.
Yeah.
We're going to be discussing it. I just wish I could say I'm really looking forward to it. I
mean, I'm assuming they're going to collect this, these four issues together in a trade.
I would imagine. If they're smart, they would also reprint the DC Universe Rebirth in there. Maybe have the half a dozen pages scattered across all the other comics of, you know, little tidbits for the arc or whatnot.
That'd be fun. That'd be fun to put out before that way. Package it that way and put it out before November.
I'm just concerned that we're not going to get anything else for the meta arc really substantive between now and then.
I'm assuming that.
They're doling it out too slowly, and that annoys me. But they're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
It's just if Doomsday Clock is another one of those things where it ends and it's just teasing the next part, that's going to lose them a lot of goodwill. Strike and a miss, or swing and a miss or whatever for this, okay, not a big deal. But do that two or three times in a row, and it's like, dude, are you ever going to do anything?
Yeah, I don't think it's the swing and a miss. I just think it's not as much as I would like. I still think it's a solid single.
I'd go so far as a double. It's certainly not a home run, though.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they really needed. This could have been something that re-energized the fan base, just like Rebirth did a year ago. And if they can build on those kinds of successes, that's what they need. Again, like you said, it wasn't horrible. It was a swing and a miss, as you're right, the wrong term. But it was a missed opportunity compared to what it could have been.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Yeah.
This is Generation X number one. I'm not sure how many times they've done a Generation X comic before. More than once, I think. At least once. This is best sum up, I think, as essentially it's a new school year at the Xavier Institute, or whichever name they want to put on the X school. A couple of things really kind of stood out to me when I was reading through this. We get a couple of kind of, you know, classic younger X-Men characters, Jubilee, Chamber, a few others, Kitty Pryde, of course.
Quentin Quire,
Glob, or whoever it is with the pink translucentness or whatever. When this new kid bumps into a redheaded telepath, I'm like, that's clearly not Jean Grey. That must be one of the Cuckoo sisters, and sure enough it was. And I'm like, really? Red hair for them? That's about as kind of disrespectful to Emma Frost as I think they could ever get. There's a certain, you know, Phoenix Jean Grey envy aspect there, at least what I read into it. A lot of these are characters that we had last seen really featured in, I'm thinking it was Wolverine and the X-Men.
Yeah, and then a little more in that terrible Spider-Man and the X-Men that followed, that volume.
Oh, right. I had forgotten about that one entirely.
Yeah, good for you. I can't. It's burned in my brain. Awful.
To me, this was just kind of run-of-the-mill stuff. This new guy's power of touch, what do they call it, psychometry or whatever, where he touches an object or a person and just kind of flashes on their backstory. It was interesting and probably a cool way to do some visual flashback sans exposition, but unless you kind of know what's going on in those images, I don't know how helpful it would be to somebody.
Not very.
For me, though, the big thing I had a hard time getting around was the art style. And it's not bad, but this Amilcar Pina is the artist. The art style reminded me, and this is going to be an obscure reference, and congratulations to anyone old enough to catch it. It reminded me of Bumpkin Buzz. I'm assuming you don't know who that is, do you, Drew?
No.
Okay. Back in the olden days, when Comic Buyer's Guide was still around, and not in the magazine form, but back in the newspaper form. So this is going back to like the 80s and 90s. There was a full-page comic called The Adventures of Bumpkin Buzz by, I think it was Brian Douglas Ahern. And it had this kind of slightly exaggerated, almost caricature-ish look to it. And there are a couple of places here where, you know, the way the noses are drawn and a few other things almost have that kind of a look to it. And it's, again, not a bad art style, but it's one that I really associate with that comic strip versus this. And just there were a few places where the use of perspective was a little odd or whatever. The characters didn't look like I recall them looking, particularly Jubilee there.
Yeah, Jubilee was the one that was the most not like I remember her character looking like. But I really liked the art style. It was just stylized. And
that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. But in some places it was almost, Jubilee was almost an anime girl. And in other places, she was a little more subdued. And yeah, and in some of the features, the nose would kind of change on some of the characters. And they'd go from sloped to pointy and widened. And so it was some, but it was always good art, but it was, yeah, definitely a stylized version that maybe wasn't as consistent as it could be.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I'm thinking, is there was a little bit of fluidity to the way the characters looked. Although I've got to say, when we get to the full page splash, when they've blown out the wall and
yeah,
Quentin is kind of yelling at him and stuff, because of where they had positioned some of his telekinetic ability and stuff in front of him, he almost looked like a teenage bald Professor X.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't see his hair. And so, yeah, that's a pretty interesting little flash forward, perhaps?
Perhaps. This wasn't a bad comic, but like I said earlier, it felt like a run-of-the-mill, it's a new year at school, let's introduce a few new students, let's kind of set up a status quo or whatever. Although I didn't really feel they set the status quo. It wasn't bad. There was no particular new twist to it. We get a cliffhanger ending that literally comes out of the blue. You know, we're warned on it on the page before the final page flip, or as we're doing the final page flip, and it's such, it's the equivalent of clickbait for a comic book. You know, the look out! Exclamation. Almost like it was put on after the fact. To get to the, oh, we're gonna end on a cliffhanger to kind of cheat to get you to come back. I mean, this cliffhanger came out of nowhere. And I want to be clear, that's nowhere as in nowhere in particular, not nowhere in all caps. That's that space, you know, thing that Peter Quill hangs out with. I just want to clarify that because, you know, Peter Quill's Kitty's ex, etc. It would have at least made more sense if the cliffhanger came out of there. But, you know, given where they've relocated the school, new rules apply as to where they can pull in extraneous or impromptu situations, cliffhangers, etc. For me, this comes down to, if you really like the school aspect of the X-Men and have been missing that, this might be the title for you. If you're not really that into that, and some of these second, third, eighth-rate kind of characters, this may not be the title for you.
I think you're right on there, because this fell somewhere between Wolverine and the X-Men, which I really loved, and Spider-Man and the X-Men, which I really hated. And so this is... There's some interesting stuff in here. It's not nothing wrong with this comic. I like some of the characters and their interactions. I think I like the art a little bit better than you did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this tacked on terrorist group at the end, we easily dispatched in a panel and a half next issue, and not much of a threat, and not much of interest to jump you into the next issue, really kind of just manufactured fake news. that really was kind of lame, and the way they threw that on there at the end, and didn't earn it. It was just out of the blue, and it just felt like it was just not a good choice. So I was disappointed in that, but yeah, I think you're right. The more you like the X school and the students, the more you want to interact with them and read about them. I think you'll appreciate this more than if you're just looking for great comics, because it's not a great comic. It's okay, but it's not great.
If you've been thinking they really should do a Jubilee in the X-Men, but take the X-Men out and just put some random lower tier character students or whatever, this is the book for you.
Yeah.
I just don't think anyone has been clamoring for this. It may do okay. If this makes it to issue 13, I will be surprised.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of curious about this whole, you know, this and Weapon X and X Gold, X Blue, so that all that stuff that got launched at the same time. I'm kind of curious as to what shakes out there. If anything is going to be really strong. Hopefully something is a strong book out of that group.
Sure hope so. This was not it for me. I'm going with a C+. It was a weak start to a title.
Yep, I'm exactly there. C+ for me as well.
Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah.
This is Star Trek The Next Generation, Mirror Broken, #1. I believe it's a 6-part storyline, miniseries or whatnot. And it is written by David and Scott Tipton. They're brothers. They've done a lot of Star Trek stuff for IDW over the years. We've got art by J.K. Woodward. It's kind of a painted style. And this is basically, well, not basically, it's entirely set in the Mirror Universe in the Next Generation era, which we've never seen those characters or whatnot in there. We did see quite a bit with Deep Space Nine. And this feels like an episode to me of Next Generation, I'm going to say around season 3 or 4 or whatever. it seemed like something they could have and should have shot and would have been really entertaining. I thought they had, and the Mirror Universe gives them some leeway here, because I thought they had the likenesses good, but there are a couple of places where, oh, they look a little different, in some cases fairly different, like Geordi. But this is not the ones we've known from the show, so they've got that leeway. They can play around with the costume designs, the look of Geordi's visor, which I thought was pretty cool. And J.K. Woodward's art style has, again, that painterly style, which I think works well for an adaptation of a live-action property, because it feels a little bit more realistic than the traditional kind of comic book line work. And I particularly enjoyed the inclusion of Lieutenant Barkley as one of the characters. Did you watch much of Next Gen?
Yeah, a lot less than I did of the original series, but I watched some.
Are you familiar with Lieutenant Barkley?
No.
When he was first introduced, he pretty much had a holodeck addiction. And he was portrayed by Dwight Schultz from the A-Team, who just did a fantastic job of a somewhat neurotic Federation officer. And they used him again over the years, including in quite a few of the movies. He was just a fun character. And again, pulling him in to kind of round out the crew of the Stargazer worked, because given the situation here of, you know, we've got the Klingons and the Cardassians kind of ganging up on what would have been the Federation, but here is the, the Empire or whatever. That takes a couple of characters kind of out of play. And I'm starting to wonder, now that I recall the Deep Space Nine, all the stuff they did in the Mirror Universe, if that's going to take some of the other characters out of play because of where they would be in this universe at this time. But I thought it was fun. I liked everything from the constant signs of clear battle damage on the Stargazer, because they'd gotten their butts kicked over the years, to just a different but familiar look and feel for the characters.
Yeah, the best part of that near episode of the original Star Trek, you know, I remember it fondly, you know, with Spock and a goatee and, you know, just a different Kirk. And I watched it. It was a long time ago, but I just remembered that feeling of you not knowing what was coming around the corner because it was so different, the character, mm-hmm. than who you knew. And this, I just assumed they had done this in the series at some point after I had stopped watching. Nope. And they had gone to that well, but it's really brilliant that they do that here with this crew. The way that Data was fantastic, you know, him kind of learning how to be this kind of version of himself,
mm-hmm.
really great. I loved putting the gang together to get the new ship, you know, and how they pulled Geordi on board. And there was, you know, these guys are bad but they're also strong characters, and they're negotiating their place in this world because it's different. And these characters are so different than what I remember from the episodes I watched, but it's fun to see them navigate still within the confines of their characters, but in this world. It was really a blast. And then the way they took over that ship and the decisions they made to kind of really set the table for, these are not good people. Mm-hmm. The choices they're making, these are not good people. And then kind of, you know, seeing a little glimpse of the politics, of how it works and the clamoring for power and trying to prove oneself in this world and what it takes to make a mark and get points and credits and things like that. I had a blast with this comic. I thought it was really cool, and I'm looking forward to reading some more.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. To me, it was clear that, and I mean, the Tiptons have done so much great stuff with Star Trek over the years at IDW that I knew going in they had a love of the property, and if they were going to tell the story, they had an interesting bent on it. And like you said, these are very different versions of characters we know, yet we can see how these are the kind of the counterpoints to the versions we know, where they're like, where they're different, you know.
Yeah, they have to be rooted in enough of the characters to show the difference, you know, otherwise it would just be foreign to you. And it just, I think, yeah, I really think it was really well executed. I mean, just from the from the little mission page at the beginning to kind of show you the difference in mission that the two worlds have. I thought that was fun with the, you know, to conquer strange worlds and enslave new life. Mm-hmm. I thought that was just a brilliant table setting right there. You know, here's where we're going. And this is really going to be fun. And I really think they did an excellent job. I don't like the painted style as much, but I can see what you were saying about how it would lend itself to something that is based on something that's been on film. Obviously, I guess, you know, it can't be photorealistic too much or else you're doing what Byrne's doing over there and you don't want to be that. So, I think you're right. It's not my favorite style, but it didn't take me out of the story at all.
It worked really well. I think they could have worked equally well with some other art styles. But it was fun. And that opening page where they show the two Kirks and reminisce about, you know, the original Mirror Universe story, that sort of a page we used to get every time we had a JLA-JSA crossover. Not as the first page, typically, but when they would introduce the other world, they would do kind of a quick aside in the story to show us two Earths, the Barry Allen Flash, the Jay Garrick Flash, explain the different vibrational, you know, hey, different worlds, different history, yada yada, back into the story kind of a thing. To me, this is reminiscent of that.
God, I wish they did that now.
Yeah, it would be helpful.
I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, although I, you know, I don't need my hand held, I think it's fun when done well.
Well, when you're only getting a parallel world, you know, story once a year or something, and it's a big deal with the JLA-JSA crossover, it made sense.
Yeah.
You know, here they had some fun stuff of just, you know, when they're in the turbo lift, there's a clear kind of splattering on the back of the turbo lift, as if somebody had recently been executed there, and yeah, they cleaned up, but maybe not totally.
Yeah.
And there was
like a sense of menace when they were. Is that what the elevator's called, the turbo lift?
The turbo lift. Wow, you really are not a Star Trek fan. Yes.
What's her name? Troyer?
Troy.
Troy.
The Inquisitor here.
Yeah, when they were together in that space, and it was kind of, the panels were kind of squeezing in on them, and it was kind of going close up on their two faces, I thought, oh, we're going towards a sexual assault situation. That's where I thought this was going. There was just a sense of menace and foreboding, and it zigged instead of zagged. So I thought that was clever, the way it was kind of leading me one way and went a different way, where she was actually holding her own and mm-hmm. actually took over the ship while he was off on the other world. So I thought that was fun as well. There's just a lot of nice touches like that where I was just really enjoying the characters. I thought the characters were really well developed and fun and evil, kind of. They're not evil with a capital E, but they do some bad stuff. Yeah, and they're all kind of some more levels than others, I guess, of meanness and badness. So maybe we'll discover some more as this thing unfolds. But so far, so good, man. This is tons of fun.
I would like to, just out of curiosity, know whose idea it was to do a few little things here and there. Like, particularly when we've got a shot of the bridge looking from, like, the view screen, we see the two stations, nav and helm, and they're labeled as such on the back of the console. I'm like, that's different. That's cool. That makes sense. But why do that? You know what I mean? To me, this is something that was just a really fun read. I'm looking forward to the rest of the miniseries. Certainly, if you're a fan of Next Generation or the Mirror Universe at all with Star Trek, this is worth checking out. This is sci-fi's definitive evil twin kind of go-to kind of a storyline, example, if you will. The reason why on South Park the evil twins or whatever always have the goatee, it's because Spock had that in the Mirror Universe episode. They did that episode of the original series. Star Trek Continues, which is a fan film production on YouTube, did a follow-up to that that takes place literally right on the heels of it. That was really well done. I'd recommend that if you really enjoyed the Next Gen or the original series episode.
Is it like found footage or?
No, completely. They've rebuilt the Enterprise. They've done like 12 or so 50-minute episodes or whatever. It's as if they continued the series. Granted, they have different actors, but like the lead actor is a very prolific voiceover artist for anime.
And they've since received a cease and desist, I'm assuming.
They've since released an episode since those were going out, so I don't know how they've swung that.
Wow.
My sister and I did an episode on Star Trek fan films and stuff, and it was one of the ones we talked about. And, I mean, they totally nail the 60s style and sensibility of Trek. And that may be why Paramount wasn't really kind of going after them versus Axanar, which was competing on modern blockbuster kind of effects and whatnot. But certainly that episode's worth checking out. And then there were four, maybe five that they did of Deep Space Nine in the Mirror Universe. I don't recall off the top of my head if we ever got any in Voyager. We might have gotten one. I'm thinking we did. I just have this vague recollection of Harry Kim as the evil universe version. But certainly we also got a good two-parter at the end of Enterprise. So if you like the Mirror Universe, there's plenty to be had. It's just a ton of fun. This was a good read. For me, I'm giving it a solid A rating.
I am at an A-. I'm just right there with you. It's really good. I'd hand this to anyone who's a marginal Star Trek fan, because I think it stands on its own as just a really good story and really well told with a lot of fun characters.
Definitely would agree with that. If you've got friends and coworkers that are Star Trek fans that you think are on the verge of becoming comic fans, this is the kind of thing to give them.
Yeah, well done.
Yeah. So I am still massively behind on my reading. Still have not finished the week of the 26th. I'm close. I've still got another half dozen or something to read. And of course, all the weeks after it, I still have quite a bit to read. I'm picking and choosing a few things from each week. From this week, I read that Batman 23.
Yeah. Yeah, and you, it sounds like I liked it a little better than you did.
That would not be hard. I am certain you liked it better than I did. I thought it was okay. I thought it was one of the weakest Batman issues I've read in a long time.
Okay. Okay, I liked it a lot better than you did.
I read the second issue of Nick Fury. Okay. I imagine you did not.
I did not.
I commented on, I think, the Slack channel, and I'll say it again here. That title is remarkably consistent. I think I could probably take my review that what we discussed on the first issue, and I think it pretty much almost verbatim applies to the second, minus one or two minor tweaks of it wasn't a car chase this time, it was something else, you know. But it was surprisingly consistent in an almost train wreck kind of a how long are they going to be able to keep this going kind of a way. If other people are loving it, great, but I'd still like to know who's on the other end of his comm and what the hell's going on.
I thought an animal-centric issue of Astro City was going to be a train wreck. I thought he had kind of gone back to the well
a little too long. I have not had time to read that one yet.
And was really pleasantly surprised at, who knew about Kurt Busiek? He's gonna be somebody.
Yeah, just give him about three decades back and start following him then. he's a crazy good writer. I'm looking forward to that. If I'd had more time, that would have been one of the next ones to read. Every time he's got some concept, it's like, really? You think that's going to work? I'm usually, yeah, it did.
Turns out it did. Yeah, it turns out that wasn't what I didn't think that was going to be anything, and it turned out all right. I like it. The Wildstorm issue 4, you know, really kind of is really working for me.
Four or three?
I think it's 4, isn't it?
I haven't read it yet. I may be a little behind. I've lost count, clearly.
Yeah, it's working a lot better than kind of Young Animal came out of the gate with some of its titles, which I think are all a little weaker. And this is a much stronger, well conceived concept. Characters are much better developed and more interesting, and the plot is something that keeps you coming back. So really, I hope people find this because it's really good, and I'm anxious to see what's next. I know they've got a big long 2-year plan for this, and I hope it's around and plenty of people are reading it so that it gets there.
I'm curious how this one doesn't trade, because I think it should get good enough word of mouth that people pick it up there, and it's a solid read as individual issues. I've got to imagine it'll work even better in trade, and it may be geared a little bit that kind of audience may like it a lot.
Yeah, I think the 1-2 punch of Superman and Super Sons was really fun, continues to be fun. I don't know if it's these are as great as some of the previous issues have been, but they're still really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Read the second issue of Greatest Adventure.
Oh.
I'm still enjoying it, but there is, I think you had concern about who are all of these characters. I don't know them.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's a valid concern. I still don't know them. When it opens with what I felt was just a grid of faces and names, I'm like, oh. But, I mean, so far, the not knowing who half of them are hasn't really slowed me down any, and I'm enjoying the series.
Which is good.
I'm trying to think what else I read this week. Not a whole lot. I read Nightwing. It's interesting, because you know how they did the issue of Titans where it was just Superman and Flash?
I'll take your word for it.
They did an issue of Titans where it was just Superman and Flash reminiscing about, hey, you recognized me. This was basically Dick Grayson and Wally West just hanging around in Bloodhaven. It was a nice character issue. It had a little action, some stuff like that, but I miss the days where they would tell enough plot and stories over the course of a year that they could spend some time, either an issue or parts of issues, whatever, with the characters just kind of hanging out together. So it was fun. I enjoyed it. I'm trying to think what else I read, because I read maybe one or two other things from this week.
Now, like last week or the week before, another issue of The Deep came out. I'm still behind on that. Are you current?
I am not current. I think one just came out this week.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anxious to see how that, because it's getting close to the end there, how they're going to button that up, but it's been fun.
Have you watched any of the stuff on Netflix for The Deep?
No, I did not.
I've watched 4 or 5 episodes. I kind of stalled out. I've had other things I've been watching, but it is exactly how I thought it would be as a cartoon, and it works well.
I did finish Riverdale, though, and I know you dropped it after the first episode, but
yep.
Man, it was really good. It was a really good series, really good first season. I think it's dropped on Netflix now, and I really liked it. Didn't really recognize any of the characters from Archie, just in name only, but it was really a fun series.
Well, and it looked like it could be a fun one, but it's just it wasn't Archie, so I think if it had been that same sort of a series without the Riverdale Archie names and connections, I probably still wouldn't have watched it. But if I had, I might have liked it a little better because it wasn't something it wasn't.
Yeah.
But we are getting to that time of year where so many TV shows are ending that I've already put up episodes on Taken, on Lethal Weapon, there's going to be a slew of television episodes coming up, so... If that's not your thing, well, every week you're still going to get the weekly comic spotlight. You're still going to get the other stuff throughout the month. But I'm watching a ton of TV, so I'm going to talk about a ton of TV. And then soon Sam and I will get together and talk about the ratings for this stuff. But yeah,
I think they finalized all the cancellations. And Sam does this thing where he does predictions on what's going to get canceled and what's going to get renewed. And it was pretty close. He was pretty close to like 80-90% right on with what the networks did with their shows, which was it's pretty impressive because it's a lot of TV.
He knows his stuff on that. It's that's why I love discussing that stuff with him. It's just fun. And there's it's such a competitive market. There are aspects of it that are very similar, I think, to the comics market and very different. But just kind of drawing the parallels and seeing how they play out differently is again something I really enjoy. But yeah, there's so much to spend the time on, and that's part of why I haven't been able to catch up on my reading, is I've been watching a lot of TV of late, but I'm also trying to get a couple episodes in the can, prepping for Comic-Con and whatnot. And of course, given how many comic book-based movies, TV shows, etc. there are, I think there'll be plenty. It's just finding the time to record them all.
I'm guessing you passed on Preacher and iZombie.
I haven't watched iZombie. I have not passed on iZombie.
Okay.
iZombie is on the list of when we get some time and we can just start doing some marathoning. We're going to do that. We stayed current on a couple of shows this season, like Legends of Tomorrow, Supergirl, Arrow, and Flash. Legends already ended. The other three end as I record this week, the week of the 22nd. So once we see the finales for those, we'll record those episodes. And then once the summer starts, hopefully that frees up a little bit of time eventually to do just, hey, let's knock out the first season of iZombie or whatever.
And you got a full season of Gotham to do?
Probably close to 2. We only got 5 episodes into the second season.
Wow. Okay, that surprises me.
It hit a a story point that I just found distasteful. It's like, I'm just not in the mood to go with that right now.
So you're more current on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. than Gotham?
Yes, actually I am.
I would have never guessed that.
And I haven't watched a single thing of this season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. yet. but that's also on the plate. But we're also, my sister and I have gotten into a bit of a rhythm lately of marathoning a couple of things. So some of the upcoming episodes, we watch that stuff in a fairly short time frame. And sometimes the shows work much better that way, because I can actually remember who the hell these characters are, versus, wait, what happened 9 months ago? In other cases, it points out maybe they're not that strong of a show. But yeah, there's a ton of things that are on the list to do. Preacher, haven't ruled it out, but it's not high on the list compared to all of these other things.
You probably did you not like the source material? It was pretty graphic.
I never read the source material.
Hmm.
I am not that well read on Vertigo. It tends to be darker and...
Certainly was.
Yeah, that's just not what I gravitate towards. I gravitate away from that. It's what I anti-gravitate towards.
Gotcha.
Anti-gravity, whatever, you know what I mean. I avoid some of that stuff. And that's also been, I don't say why I've been reluctant to watch iZombie. I've actually been very eager to watch it, but it's also something that I don't necessarily want to watch certain things as I sit down to eat dinner, which is what we typically start, you know, doing.
Yeah, but it's very playful. I don't think they don't do any gore. I mean, they're harsh themes, but I think it's pretty playful violence.
But that's the kind of show that what we may do is start on an evening where it's like, okay, let's eat dinner while we watch an episode of this other show, and then do three or four episodes of iZombie or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's just there's so much to watch right now. Part of why I hadn't read more this week is, as we record this on a Monday, because I've got some stuff going later in the week, we're recording a day early. Yesterday on Sunday, I recorded with TJ, and I edited four other episodes, three of which were TV episodes. So that meant recently I've watched a ton of television. Again, rough problem to have, first world problem, I get it, but...
In comparison, it takes us 10 to 15 minutes to read a comic. That's being generous probably with some of these comics that we read. And we do three of those to prepare for a weekly comic spotlight. And, you know, sometimes there's Wikipedia involved and some notes that need to be taken. But in comparison, you don't have to watch 22 episodes of 22 hours of television and then record a couple hours on that. So it's quite an endeavor to do that. Take that.
Any television episode is a bare minimum of at least 8 hours of watching, and that's if it's a short run show. And if it's something like an Arrow or Flash that's going like 23 episodes, even if we take out the commercials, because we blast through those, I don't need to buy any of that. You know, I've got a car, whatever. That's still 16, 17, 18 hours of viewing just right there. So yeah, the TV shows take a while to do, but you know, and that's part of why I go almost a little further afield than strictly comic book based shows, because it's like, I've watched them, I want to go ahead and talk about them. You know, that's how come we got things like Taken and Lethal Weapon and stuff. I think this audience we've got is interested in that kind of stuff, particularly if some of it's good, which both of those shows I thought were. But it is one of those things where I've got a couple of movies on the stack to do, because there's something nice about watching for about, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and then recording, and then you're done. Other than the editing and the release, but still.
It probably feels like a break for you to do a movie episode.
Sometimes. And again, we've got a bunch of those. There's one that is going to cut to the head of the line just because of the timing of it. I don't want to reveal what it is on the off chance I don't do it, but I've got one that should be a lot of fun to go watch and discuss. And if I pay attention, I think I can do it timely to where it plays into something else. But again, there's
is it Babe, Pig in the City?
Damn it! Gotta pick something else. No, it's yeah. I could basically retire and keep pretty busy full-time just watching TV and recording about that, and same with the comics and stuff like that. It's fun to do, but alas, I have to earn a paycheck.
Let's figure that out. Let's figure out. That sounds fun.
That's on my list. So we're nearing the end of the month. Any moment now, any day now, if Yeah, and certainly by the time this episode goes up, the online solicits should be there on the preview stuff. They should be already out elsewhere. I haven't really paid attention to the forum today to find out if Jason or Brawlinator or somebody else has already posted them. Huge help when you guys do that, because I'm usually busy enough trying to get the episodes up and other things that hitting the other websites to go find the solicits, it just doesn't always happen. Matter of fact, if it were up to me, if I had to be doing it, you probably wouldn't be seeing them, and that would just kind of suck. Because on the 31st, previews comes out. That means the previews spotlight deadline is June 10th. We had an awesome turnout this last time. Tons of great clips, a lot of fun stuff. Looking forward to a repeat of that.
Yeah, a lot of new voices. It was fun.
Oh, yeah. Love that. The comic book page teleconference is going to be Saturday, June 17th. The teleconference, we start at 7 p.m. Central Time. And basically, I start when the first person says, hey, you're ready to start the call? At which point I say yes, we start talking. And then from there, people can come and go as they please and stuff like that. It's a ton of fun. We had a great turnout this last time. Discussion went on for quite some time. A number of different topics. Loved it. Next month after that, for July, not sure when or if we'll be able to have the teleconference just because of the timing of when I go to Comic-Con and stuff like that. We'll play it by ear. And I'm figuring that preview spotlight deadline will be like July 8th. So hopefully people will have the previews and have some time over the 4th of July to send in their clips. Always sending them in a little early is appreciated. I know it's not always possible, but, you know, for July, again, because I'll be leaving for Comic-Con, that would be a huge help too. But again, we got to get through June first. Plenty of stuff. Yeah. So like I said, plenty of television episodes coming up. Tons of comics to be reading and enjoying. Hopefully everybody's finding stuff that they're liking. We've had some great discussions on the Slack channel, on the forum and stuff like that. Had some very interesting emails of late. Definitely appreciate all of that. So anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
Nope, that'll do it.
Cool. Join us next time as we discuss Justice League of America number 7 from DC, Venom number 150 from Marvel, and Saucer State number 1 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.